Welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main story. I'm Marco Supran for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
And let me reiterate here that Canada stands firmly beside Ukraine in response to Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, as well as its support to insurgents in eastern Ukraine.
Ви не були радикали, і ті, хто, умовно кажучи, їми маніпулював.
BBRD accepted the role of the Chernobyl Shelter Fund manager back in 1997, with a full awareness, even then, of the magnitude, the complexity of the task, but also with enthusiasm, because of the importance of the project for the people of Ukraine, but for the entire world.
Тож за минулу добу внаслідок бойових дій один український військовослужбовець загинув, двоє отримали поранення.
25 years ago, on December 1st, 1991, Ukrainians went to the polls and were asked a simple question. Do you support the Act of Independence for Ukraine? The Verkhovna Rada, or Parliament of Ukraine, adopted an Act of Independence on August 24th, 1991. Back then, during the evening of August 18th, President of the Soviet Union Mikhail Gorbachev was at his dacha, or summer retreat, on the Crimean Peninsula. The USSR State Committee on State Emergencies surrounded him and proposed that he voluntarily resign. What is now known as the Gang of Eight tried to orchestrate a coup that failed and a provisional government collapsed by August 22nd. They were hardline communists and were opposed to Gorbachev's new union treaty that was supposed to allocate more power to the Soviet Union's constituent republics. Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that thanks to the efforts of a group of nationally conscious Ukrainians led by Narodny Rukh, the People's Movement faction, they were able to adopt the Act of Independence. However, that Act of Independence was conditional on a referendum that was then scheduled for December 1, 1991. 22 years later, on December 1, 2013, over a million people took to the streets to protest the Yanukovych regime's return to Soviet-style repression, and in so doing, turned the students' Euromaidan protest into the revolution of dignity. Chairman of Ukraine's parliament, Andriy Poruby, spoke at the opening of the parliamentary session, recalled the results of the referendum in which over 90% of voters supported the Act of Independence. According to Ukrinform, he said it was, quote-unquote, paradoxical, but a natural phenomenon that Ukrainians supported independence, that they support freedom, freedom for which hundreds of thousands of the best sons and daughters of Ukraine died for in the struggle against occupation, in prison, or in exile. He also said that the referendum of December 1 was the funeral of the evil empire, the Soviet Union. Later in the show, Marta Dychuk will speak with Nestor Gajovsky, a Canadian diplomat in Kyiv at Canada's consular office, and will hear about some of the behind-the-scenes movements to recognize the re-establishment of Ukraine's independence. It's an exclusive interview and offers an inside look at international power politics, particularly how Canada played a leading role in defending liberty at the end of the 20th century. The International Monetary Fund was in Ukraine from November 3rd through to the 17th, and Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that Ukraine received a four-year, $17.5 billion loan package back in March of 2015. That loan package is distributed to Ukraine in tranches, something called the Extended Fund Facility. Ukraine has so far received almost half of the loan, around $7.5 billion. When the IMF delegation was in Kyiv, the Ukrainian government was hoping the IMF would release another round of funding, but the answer, according to the Atlantic Council, was a resounding no. Quote, in plain language, this means that plenty remains to be done and that it will take quite some time. The IMF will not provide Ukraine with any more funding this year, and it does not even give any hint when it may, according to Anders Asland. The IMF mission was led by Ron Van Ruden and issued a statement concluding three things: that the authorities in Ukraine need more time to implement policies to ensure medium-term fiscal sustainability, the economy is showing welcome signs of recovery, but that strength and durability of that recovery depend on the implementation of reforms to support the transition to a full-fledged market economy. The statement is apparently one of the toughest made because it focuses on governance, which is a euphemism for rooting out corruption. We'll include a link to the IMF statement on our website. President Poroshenko held a meeting with Suma Chakrabarty, president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Poroshenko expressed his gratitude for the bank's leading role in gaining international support to overcome the effects of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant explosion back in 1986. Earlier this week, reactor number 4 at Chernobyl was enclosed by a new shelter to prevent radiation leaks. The structure is airtight and is the largest land-based movable object ever constructed at 162 meters or 531 feet long and 108 meters high and cost 1.5 billion euros, according to The Guardian. Remote-controlled cranes will work inside this new structure to dismantle the sarcophagus that was built back in 1986 to contain the tons of uranium but has been unstable and was expected to collapse. Both President Poroshenko and EBRD President Chakrabarty were present at the reactor site as the new sarcophagus officially covered the reactor. Poroshenko noted that the EBRD remains the largest financial investor in Ukraine for energy, transportation, and financial projects. Ukraine's 2017 budget allocated 3.2 billion hryvnia to provide monthly targeted assistance for IDPs, or internally displaced persons, to help cover the cost of living in new places. The actual amount of assistance that a person gets varies from 442 hryvnia for able-bodied and 884 hryvnia for people with disabilities or have lost their ability to work. According to the Ministry of Social Policy, as of November 14, there were 1,664,890 people registered as internally displaced from Crimea and the Donbas. 1,045,634 applied for assistance, and 962,779 qualified to receive the assistance. From the beginning of 2016, Ukraine has spent roughly 2.6 billion hryvnia on this assistance program. Ukraine's government also adopted a series of resolutions regarding changes in healthcare this week. Prime Minister Volodymyr Groysman said at the meeting of the cabinet that healthcare reform is one of the most unpopular, but one of the most important. The government's program is supposed to bring about a national health insurer and budget funds that were formerly allocated according to a Soviet model that distributed costs, for example, according to the number of beds in a hospital, whether or not those hospital beds had patients in them. During an interview on Ukraine's Channel 5, Deputy Minister of Health Pavlo Kovtonyuk said that in Europe, Ukraine has the second largest number of hospital beds, yet the people are not more healthy because of it, and a large number of hospitals are simply ineffective and a drain on limited resources. The government system represents a change because money will now follow a patient and afford them a level of independence they earlier did not have. Patients were forced to go to see a doctor based on their geography or enter the free market and pay heavy out-of-pocket costs. With the government's new system, a patient can choose their doctor of choice. Healthcare employees will also see a 30% increase in their salaries, and the government plans to increase the amount allocated to purchase medicines to about 2 billion hryvnia. The new National Health Service is supposed to be rolled out over 2017. Ukraine's state oil and gas company, NAK Naftogaz Ukraine, is celebrating its freedom from Russian natural gas, according to Forbes. A year ago, the natural gas giant stopped importing natural gas from Russia. Naftogaz wrote on their website that this is a major milestone in Ukraine's independence because, quote, just 3 years ago, gas was a major symbol of Ukraine's political and economic dependence on its northern neighbor. This dependence, being maintained through manipulating volumes of supply and prices for Russian gas, forced Ukraine into political and economic concessions. Naftogaz asserts that, quote, the attempts of the Russian leadership to use gas for political pressure on Ukraine are not efficient anymore. This gas independence was the result of coordinated work by the presidential administration, the cabinet, the parliament, Western partners, and international financial institutions. The Russian Federation Ministry of Defense issued a threat to Ukraine this week that will take Russia's hybrid war against Ukraine to a new level. Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that we mentioned Ukraine will be testing a new missile defense system. Radio Liberty reports that Ukraine has already started 2 days of missile tests in the Black Sea, and in response, the Russian Ministry of Defense put their occupation forces in the Crimean Peninsula on high alert. A spokesperson for the Russian MOD said that Ukraine was trying to escalate the conflict. The missile tests are supposed to run on December 1st and 2nd. Oleksandr Turchinov, secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, asked the Russians to stop panicking about Ukraine's missile tests. According to Uniyan, Turchinov said that the tests are being held in accordance with international norms and obligations and, moreover, are being held and conducted in Ukraine's sovereign airspace. At a ceremony honoring the Kolchitsky Battalion of the National Guard, President Poroshenko said that Ukraine will, quote, continue with its training exercises, including missile defense systems testing, because over the past 23 years, the surface-to-air defense system of Ukraine was ruined, and our responsibility today is to build an air defense system to protect Kyiv and all of Ukraine, and no one will stop us. We will act in the security interests of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian state. Ukraine Security Service, the SBU, filed a criminal case against Member of Parliament Alexander Onishchenko for state treason. The head of the investigation division of the SBU, Georgi Ostafichuk said that in the course of their investigation regarding possible financing of separatism, they uncovered facts that support their case against Onishchenko for treason, namely an SMS, Simple Messaging System Service, exchange that revealed he has a Russian passport and that he agreed to work with Russian handlers to destabilize Ukraine, according to the SBU's Twitter feed and the Ukrinform press agency. Russian proxy forces continue to fire upon Ukrainian positions every day. On December 1st, they opened fire with 122mm caliber weapons, as well as 120 and 82mm mortars in the towns of Shirokine, Krasnohoryvka, Mariinka, all in the direction of Mariupol along the entire contact line. Tanks were also used against Ukrainian positions in Shirokine, which is roughly 23 kilometers from Mariupol. Grenade launchers were reported being shot at Ukrainian positions in Stanitsa Luhanska. The press center of the anti-terrorist operation concludes that the Russian proxy forces are making a push toward Mariupol based on the amount of shelling seen in that direction over the past week. Earlier in the week, the towns of Toretsk and Horilka and the surrounding villages had their water supply interrupted because the waterworks system that supplies water to the area was damaged due to shelling. Schools were closed as a result, and the towns are also without heating. The ATO press center announced the area is on the verge of a humanitarian disaster. Ukrainian utility services have been at the ready to begin work on repairing the pipeline, but the Russian proxy forces refused to institute a ceasefire to ensure their safety. Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov, foreign minister of the Russian Federation, said in an interview for Italian news site Corriere della Sera that, quote, the assertion about the presence of Russian heavy weaponry in the southeast of Ukraine is science fiction. And speaking about fiction, on Monday, Yanukovych gave testimony via Skype from his safe haven in the Russian town of Rostov-on-Don about the mass killings on February 18th to the 20th, 2014, that happened in Kyiv just before he fled to Russia. He made the bold assertion that his convoy was shot at by right sector radicals the night he fled Kyiv, something that has not been corroborated by any news agency or investigation. Yanukovych claims to have forgotten almost everything else, however, including several phone calls he made to Russian President Vladimir Putin and calls that were made to other Russian phone numbers, according to Financial Times journalist Roman Oliarchik.
On December 1, 1991, Ukrainians were given the opportunity to vote for their future for the first time in modern history. There was a referendum on independence, and over 90% of the population voted yes. A day later, Canada recognized these referendum results, in fact, confirming Ukraine's independence internationally. Nestor Gajewski was the Canadian diplomat in Kyiv who navigated this process, and he has kindly agreed to speak with Romadske Radio and give us a peek behind the scenes of what was going on, what led to this decision. Mr. Gajewski, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you pull back the curtain and tell us what led to the decision that Canada made to recognize Ukraine's independence back in 1991? We remember that the United States was actually opposed to the USSR falling apart. They wanted the USSR to stay together. They were not interested in Ukraine's independence. They did not recognize it until after Gorbachev had resigned. And yet Canada took this move, and right after the referendum results, they were the ones that came in and said, yes, we recognize this. What was happening behind the scenes? You were at the negotiations. You were a key player in this.
We have to go back in time a little bit to remembering how we even opened the office, our consulate in Kyiv. Prime Minister Mulroney was working very hard on East-West relations, and particularly with German Chancellor Schroeder. In fact, Schroeder, in one of his books, mentions Mulroney by name and saying Mulroney made a tremendous contribution to the improvement of East-West relations, and particularly with respect to the Soviet Union, Europe, and the West situation. So Mulroney was eminently political. He understood the aspirations, for example, of Canadians of Ukrainian origin wishing to see some sort of activity on behalf of the Republic of Ukraine. And he responded to that over time. When he made his visit to Moscow in 1989, he announced there that Canada was going to open a consulate. And this flew, I think, against the, as you said, the current, because the Americans were trying very, very hard to support Gorbachev for two reasons. One, they had managed to obtain many concessions favorable to themselves with respect to the Soviet Union, the armament race, and human rights. And secondly, I think a very warm relationship had developed between the American politicians and Gorbachev, and one politician trying to help another. So they were very focused on Ukraine. And there was Mr. Mulroney,
the Canadian Prime Minister at the time.
Canadian Prime Minister. The Americans had, once upon a time, had intended going into Ukraine back in the 1980s, but Afghanistan intervened, and so they withdrew their option to open a consulate. And here was Canada sort of butting into the business. There was some resistance, I think, within the Canadian political establishment to the idea of a consulate, and it worked itself out a little bit in the year 1991. After I got there...
Can you remind us when you arrived? Sorry to interrupt. Can you remind us?
I arrived there in January 1991 to open an office, whatever we tried. And in that period, January to roughly the end of March, the Canadian budget was being developed. And at one point, very serious attention was given to the question of whether we should indeed open the consulate and keep the consulate open in Kiev.
May I ask, what were the arguments? What were the reasons for and what were the reasons against?
I think within the Department of External Affairs at the time, they were pretty much accepting the American line that, you know, we've got to support Gorbachev. He's doing a terrific job in the country. At least they thought he was doing a terrific job. Whereas the various Soviet republics were thinking otherwise, as well as the population. So I think there was a big misreading of the situation, and the external affairs people sympathized with the American viewpoint. There was a budgetary crisis. External was being hammered, I believe, at the time by some budget cuts, and they were looking for ways of cutting expenses. And I think Kiev came up on the chopping block. So that was the situation then, but the people in external forgot that it was also, 1991 was also the 100th anniversary of the Ukrainian settlement in Canada. And to open an office and then to try and close an office was politically unacceptable. And so after a short tussle, I learned that, yes, indeed, we were going to maintain the office.
And so good thing that they didn't close it, because then important things happened. You were there during the coup, during the Declaration of Independence.
I think Canada was very, very lucky at the time, because the other countries that were not there, particularly from Europe, the French were already trying to establish themselves in Kiev. The Germans had already been there for a couple of years, but there weren't any other real Western countries represented there. And only when the business of the coup and the independence of Ukraine began to come forward did the other countries suddenly start sending their various diplomats to establish representation in Kiev. We were very lucky.
So you were really one of the very first Western diplomats to be posted in Ukraine at that historic moment. In the months between the Declaration of Independence in August of 91 and the referendum in December of 91, you must have been a key source of information for Ottawa and other countries, since you were on the ground and you were watching things. Can you give our listeners a sense of what the discussions were in those intervening months leading up to the referendum?
Well, it's hard. I think there's a little bit of exaggeration here as to how much influence or role I or any Western diplomat played at the time, because you have to remember that it is the embassies that are providing the political judgments that are sent back to the home countries. Certainly consulates and the officers there can provide information to the embassies. This was particularly the situation for the Americans. The American Consul General arrived there in February 1991, about a month after I did.
This would have been John Stepanchuk?
No, this was...
John Gunderson.
John Gunderson.
That's right.
And the situation there was interesting because I learned over time that if he was reporting on the Ukrainian situation, he had to go up to Moscow and write his reports in Moscow. And in Moscow, they were very much against the view that the Ukraine was really pushing that hard and that independence was looming on the horizon. There was a difference of opinion between the consulate and the American consulate in Ukraine and the American embassy in Moscow, which was presenting, I think, the Reagan line, which was, you know, we've got to keep Gorbachev in power, which also, that idea also led in the June of 1991 to the famous Chicken Kiev speech, where President Bush came and said, you know, you've got to be careful about breaking up a big monolith like this and think carefully about it, because the Americans have been hurt, very hurt by the what happened in Yugoslavia, and they didn't want to see the breakup of the Soviet Union leading to the same consequences. So there was some tension between, I think, the reports that probably John was sending and the information that I was sending. Now, sending information from Kiev to Canada for me was extremely difficult. We had the time distance, 8-9 hours, depending on the time of year. My day would be ending and Ottawa would just be coming online. I had no means of communication other than the telephone line, which, as you will remember very well, telephones didn't work very well in Ukraine. And if I had to make a long distance call, I had to reserve a time and ask that a call be made at such and such a time, and the call had to proceed through Moscow. And there were often large delays, and the times that I had set were often ignored, so that sometimes I would be staying up in my apartment office waiting for a phone call as late as 10 and 11 o'clock at night. Written communication was difficult because most consulates and embassies of Canada at the time had some direct communication with Ottawa through a particularly secure system. I had no such arrangement in Kiev. I had to rely on the telephone system. Faxing was almost impossible. The reason was that there were very few fax machines in Ukraine at the time. The hotel had one. To access it, we had to get permission. Permission had to be granted by a security staff member. I don't know if that staff member was in the hotel or if they had to go to the local Secret Service office to get permission. Because fax machines, you will remember, were printing presses and therefore controlled.
Absolutely. This was a communication device controlled by the state. Thank you for all that rich detail. You've actually touched on two questions that I wanted to follow up on. I remember on the 2nd of December, right after the referendum results had come in and the 90% yes vote was in, there was a celebration that was organized by, I believe, the Ruch, the Democratic opposition of the time. And I remember you rushing in late. And the band was asked to stop playing. You were given the microphone and you read out the announcement that Canada had recognized Ukraine's referendum results, therefore its independence. Now, how did you manage to do that so quickly, given, as you've just described, the communications challenges that you faced, the fact that you had to liaise with Moscow and Ottawa? Can you just describe those that day between the referendum results and announcing them?
Certainly. To describe what happened is quite interesting, actually. I think it was September, Barbara MacDougall, our Minister of External Affairs, paid a visit to Ukraine. This was fairly soon after the August coup. to set the record straight as to what Canada was hoping and expecting from the new Ukrainian leadership. And while she was there, she brought with her a satellite phone setup. Now, that satellite phone setup was sort of brought in illegally because we never sought permission from either the Soviet or Ukrainian establishment to operate a private telephone line out of Kiev. But anyway, Barbara MacDougall left that telephone system with me, and it was put into the third room of my hotel apartment, which was also serving as my kind of administrative office area. And we had this telephone ready to go on the December the 1st. December the 1st came, we had an observer group from Canada, you may remember, that came, parliamentarians and other people, some from the I think Prime Minister's office as well, to take a look at the vote and to see how the election was conducted. And they reported back to Ottawa at the same time using the satellite phone, explaining that everything had gone very, very nicely and properly in the best kind of voting standards available. And by that time, we had a pretty good idea that if the vote was large enough, that Canada would be prepared to recognize Ukraine as an independent nation. So I received a phone call on that satellite phone, that illegal satellite phone, in the evening, and it worked like this. The message came over the phone to me. I repeated the words to Ann Collins, who was down from the Moscow embassy. She took the words down, and once I had received the entire message, she went down to our other office and typed out the statement on vellum paper so that we could then present it to the president, the new president of Ukraine. I was ordered to take that document to the new president of Ukraine. So I picked up the phone and I called the Ukrainian foreign minister, Zelenko, with whom I had very good relations. I had his private office number, and I got him and I said, look, I've got this document, which I think you'll be very interested in, and I've got to present it to President Kravchuk. And he understood what was involved. So we got together a party. Patrick Boye, who was a member of parliament and that time, I think, one of the ministers of state, I think, helping the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Joe Clark, at the time, was part of the party, as well as a representative from the office of the Prime Minister. And we drove out to President Kravchuk's dacha, passing through several checkpoints, and we delivered the message there and then. And it was that's how it transpired. We worked on this phone. Another story about the phone I think is amusing, and that is that sometime in Barbara MacDougall left the phone there in September. Sometime in late November, Foreign Minister Zelenko of Ukraine called me up and said, look, I've got to get an urgent message to Czechoslovakia. Can I use your phone? Now, I had never told anyone that the phone was there, but I'm sure the hotel staff had reported it. So I said, sure, come on ahead. So he came in, he made his phone call, thanked me very much, and that was it. So things were very loosey-goosey at the time, as you'll remember. Oh, and yes. It was a charming time, really indeed. And that's how that event transpired, and that stopping the ban, I think that was in the Libet Hotel at the time.
Yes, you actually anticipated my next question, because I was wondering the sequence of events, because you came and made the announcement to the then opposition Ruch, but I was wondering who was the first to hear, and you've already answered that. And how much contact did you have with Leonid Kravchuk, who was Speaker of Parliament, who then became President on December the 1st? How much contact did you have with both sides? Because there was the sort of the majority and the opposition, and you as the diplomat watching and reporting, presumably you had to have discussions with...
As I said, I wasn't able... If I did any reporting, it came later, I think, after independence. Up to that period, it was very, very difficult. I was a one-man show. I had hired some staff. I had actually been looking forward to a very easy summer. By August, the office was working very, very comfortably, and I thought, my goodness, this is a breeze. I've got nothing to do. I can hardly communicate. I knew what was going on. I was talking to certainly the opposition. We rarely talked to the communist side there for some reason. They didn't want to contact us, the foreign Western diplomats, and we didn't sort of go after them very much.
But you did have contact with Leonid Kravchuk, who was the Speaker
of
Parliament.
Yes, I did. And some of his staff, that was interesting because later on when he made his trip to Canada in September 1991, I had a fair amount of contact with him and his staff, particularly his staff, because after all, he was extremely busy. He had just been promoted from very quickly from... propaganda chief for the Communist Party. He became the chairman of the Ukrainian parliament, which was a very powerful position in Soviet times. And then when the head of the Communist Party went to work for Mr. Gorbachev, effectively, Kravchuk became the leader, the undeclared leader of the Communist Party and of the country. And then in a short period after the coup and the election in December the 1st, he became president. So this happened very, very quickly in a period of about a year to a man who had sort of been hidden in obscurity for a long time. I'll tell you another story, which will be in the memoir. And this was at the time Kravchuk was going to Canada. Well, while I was there, I developed very, very good relations with particularly people in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Tarasyuk, for example, became a very good friend, and a few others, and Zelenko as well. But anyway, I was always kidding them about the flag on their car, because they had the Soviet Ukrainian flag on their cars, official cars, and I said, listen, if you go to Canada and you have that flag, you're going to cause a riot. And I talked to them about that. I spoke about that to Mr. Kravchuk, and I kept reminding his two assistants who really handled the details of his trip. So they came up with that act of the, not an act, but Postanova, kind of declaration, kind of decree, saying that for the purposes of travel abroad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they would use the traditional blue-yellow flag. All right? So I persuaded them that, listen, if you're going to Canada, you better do that because it's very, very important. And so a few days later, after having discussed this again, my friends from President Kravchuk's staff came to me with three pieces of paper, and it was the document that had been approved in Parliament to have the blue and yellow flag as representative of Ukraine. And it even had, the ink was still even wet on one of the documents Mr. Kravchuk had signed, that this was the way it was going to be because he was the chairman of Parliament. So they said to me, is this satisfactory? And I said, absolutely. And that's one of the things. I feel that I really reminded them that they had to go to Canada with a blue and yellow flag.
That's such a wonderful story. I will look forward to reading your memoirs, as I'm sure all the listeners of Ukraine Radio. Well, in 1991, you were the right man in the right place at the right time to navigate this very complicated process in Canada's recognition of Ukraine's statehood, because in 1990, when Lithuania had declared independence, nobody recognized it. and therefore nothing changed. And in 1991, with Canada's recognition of the independence, that was actually a key moment. You are now enjoying retirement on Canada's west coast and have had time to look back over this time. What is it that strikes you now, looking back at those events, as being something that was surprising, significant, that you only realized in retrospect?
I think looking back, surprising. I think the degree to which what I would call Sovietism and communism, the 75 years of sort of Soviet power, how deeply it has had penetrated Ukrainian society. It's a way of thinking, a way of, it's a very kind of corrupt approach to civic life, a very deadly, cunning one in many ways. I regard some of the politicians who emerged out of the Soviet system as being top-notch politicians in the sense of being able to achieve their objectives. No one has been able to control a former Soviet bureaucracy. It hasn't happened in Russia, and it certainly hasn't happened in Ukraine. And one looks back at this and wonders, why was it so difficult for Ukraine in 25 years to make changes, such as changes occurred in the next-door neighbor Poland, when in 1991 they were roughly economically equal, and now Poland has pulled far ahead of Ukraine in terms of economics and the GDP and average salaries and so on. So that's really what has struck me, is what has prevented the Ukraine from becoming a modern democratic state. The aspirations are there. There's much hope with the young. But the problems of extricating themselves from communism, from Sovietism, that kind of thinking is very, very difficult. You see it every day in the newspaper reports. People are being arrested for this or that corruption. A lot of people are being arrested. I read very rarely of anyone going to jail. What is it that is preventing the legal system from responding? Well, we know it appears that the judicial system has been totally corrupted. And it wasn't just Mr. Yanukovych, the deposed president, that corrupted it. It had already been well established by the Soviet system. So I think that, looking back, that is the thing that troubles me most. Why is proving so difficult to move that society in the democratic tradition when there are some wonderful people there? The young people are coming up, pushing for it, but my goodness, how slow the progress is.
Well, you have a perspective of 25 years. You've seen various presidents leading Ukraine. Let's look forward. What do you see happening in Ukraine in the next 25 years? What would you like to see happening, and what do you think needs to happen?
Well, I think you do need a reform of the legal system. You need a reform of the judiciary, the business with the procuracy, and now the Corruption Bureau. All these mechanisms either have to be improved or changed, and there has to be a will. And it has to be decisive, because you just cannot afford to stand still. I think the Russia is sliding backwards, and I think that Ukraine has the opportunity to move forward. In fact, if Ukraine wants to regain Crimea or even have some appeal for people living in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas, I think it has to show how much more beneficial a democratic way of life is to what is now being offered to those areas and to Russia.
You mentioned Crimea that's been annexed by Russia, eastern Ukraine that has entities calling themselves the Donetsk People's Republic, Luhansk People's Republic. They've had events that they've called referenda there, but they have not received international recognition. And that just once again underlines the importance of international recognition of events that are referenda that have to be democratic, properly observed in order to be recognized. Hopefully you will be visiting Ukraine in the near future, and we'll
next
have
year
another conversation, what you see on the ground in Kyiv. Mr. Gajowski, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Art and culture were large parts of the Euromaidan protests of 2013 to 2014. On the third anniversary of the beginning of the protests, many cultural events were held. The country's premier art space, the Grand Mestetsky Arsenal in central Kyiv, hosted a ceremony at which the president announced the creation of a museum of revolution and dignity would be constructed on the site where the Heavens Company Euromaidan activists were killed by snipers in the last days of the protests. Ukraine's Institute of National Memory, which has been a driving force behind the project, had a few projects of its own. Director Volodymyr Vyatrovich and his colleagues presented a new book. It's called Maidan, First Person, Art on the Barricades, Maidan від першої особи, мистецтво на барикадах, and is based on interviews collected with people who participated in the protests. Edited by Tatiana Kovtunovich and Tatiana Provalko, it's the second in a series of publications based on the Institute's own oral history project. Inside are memories of famous and ordinary people. Well-known writer Andrei Kurkov, author of the Penguin novels, the bard Taras Kompanichenko, two well-known figures from Ukraine's rock folk genre, Oleksandr Yarmola and Dmytro Kushnir, leader and drummer of the band Haidamake, were interviewed. There are also voices of new artists who emerged during the protest. The book can be freely downloaded and we'll post a link on our website. Many films were produced during and about the revolution. Some were by established media companies like Studio One Plus One, others by small groups of artists who came together to film, document, and share. A list of some of the better ones include The Winter That Changed Us, co-produced by One Plus One and Babylon 13, a documentary film The Maidan Massacre by U.S. director John Beck Hoffman, and Women's Faces of Revolution. For a longer list, check out our website. A very different Ukrainian film called My Grandmother, Fanny Kaplan, won the Best Foreign Film Award at the London Crystal Palace International Film Festival in London last week. It's about a little-known real-life love story between Vladimir Lenin's brother Dmitry and a terrorist, Fanny Kaplan. The film was screened at this year's Odessa Film Festival, and the original soundtrack is by Eurovision winner Jamala. You can see the trailer on our website. Holy Ukrainianization Batman! Finally, the news I've been waiting for my entire life. Ukrainian publisher Rydna Mova just announced that they won the rights to publish DC Comics in Ukrainian. They'll be working together with fellow geeks and nerds that organize the annual Kyiv Comic Con, and they expect the first issues to appear in the spring of 2017. They announced their search for comic book fans to help with the translation, so I'm not sure I can guarantee I'll be around next year. Hopefully, Marvel will jump on the bandwagon soon. A song called Brother to Brother became the informal anthem of the Maidan protests. It was written well before the protests began, but on 1 December 2013, when Kozak System and Shabia got together to rehearse the piece, many others joined them. You've probably heard it by now, but here it is anyway. Enjoy.
Свій за свого. Рідний мій. нікого не зійме руку. Брат на брата не скаже свого. Прийме удар, піде на муку. Брат на брата, свій за свого.
We'll keep watching these and other stories as they develop. If you have any questions or would like to know more, write us at ukrainecalling@hromadskyradio.org. I'm Marco Suprin in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.